Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Florida farm workers and their supporters are fasting for the third day outside of the Manhattan hedge fund offices of Wendy's billionaire board chair, Nelson Peltz. The farm workers are members of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, an organization that pushes corporate food giants to adopt better labor practices. Farm workers are calling on Wendy's specifically to sign on to the Fair Food Program, which was created by Florida tomato pickers. Farm workers say the program has created a mechanism for women to report and stop sexual harassment without fear of retaliation. More than a dozen large restaurant chains have signed on to the program. After Florida tomato suppliers implemented the program, Wendy's canceled its Florida contract and now purchases tomatoes from Mexico. The company says they refuse to be pushed into paying fees to the coalition. They say all of their suppliers undergo third-party certified human rights assessments. Farm workers say they will fast until they march this Thursday. And joining us with the latest is Marley Moynihan. Marley works for the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, and she joins us from New York. Hi, Marley. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. We're also joined by Dr. Anne Lopez, researcher and farm worker advocate. Anne is executive director of the Center for Farm Worker Families in California, a nonprofit dedicated to advocacy and support for farm worker families. Hi, Dr. Anne Lopez. Welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, it's great to have you. Marley, I want to start off with you. I read, according to reports, that 70 farm workers are on day three of the fast, along with many supporters. Is that about right?
Yes, in fact, that number is growing every day. So over the last several days since the launch of the fast, we've had additional supporters come to join us here in New York and begin to fast alongside us. In addition to fasters, there's also farmworker families. We have over 30 children and youth who are here from Immokalee as well, supporting their parents in this effort, as well as students and religious leaders and other community leaders from all across the country. And we have many more coming for the march in a few days.
What is the atmosphere like on the ground, and how are people doing?
I think everybody's spirits are very high. There's something very inspiring about coming together to take an action for such an important cause. And I think it is a space of celebration as much as it is a space of protest, because the Fair Food Program has been so effective in transforming the lives of not only women in the fields, but also men, and eliminating many of these endemic human rights abuses. And so there's a sense of hope and a sense of potential that everyone shares and can see on the horizon that this could actually be a model that takes off, that transforms agriculture. And so in many ways, there's a sense of excitement as well as determination in order to ensure that these rights do reach the many millions of farm workers who in this country still are laboring under horrific labor conditions and who need this program to expand.
The Coalition of Immokalee Workers has been calling for a boycott of Wendy's for years, so this is not new. They've been trying to get the company to sign on to the Fair Food Program for a long time. According to a Huffington Post report from 2015, Immokalee, Florida, was once home to very serious human rights abuses in agribusiness, including agricultural slavery rings. This got a lot of attention when it came out. Tell us a little bit more about this Fair Food Program.
Absolutely. So the Fair Food Program is a worker-driven social responsibility model, which means that it's rooted in two essential elements that distinguish it from many other types of social responsibility. First, there is worker participation and leadership. It is essential that not only workers are at the table, but at the head of the table in informing the process, everything from the code of conduct and what the right should be, and of course, having a voice in the workplace, having their right to speak freely, protected, so that they can report abuse when it does happen and help be monitors of their own rights. Secondly, a WSR program is distinguished by enforcement. So not only is there a code of conduct, not only is there a structure for the program, but there is meaningful consequences for failure. There are market consequences behind failing to respect farm workers' rights in the form of legally binding agreements with major companies like Wendy's competitors, whether it's Taco Bell or McDonald's, who say that they simply will not buy from farms that permit sexual assault or permit slavery. And so the reason that these WSR programs work so effectively is because of this combination of different mechanisms. So we have worker-to-worker education, so workers are deeply informed about what their rights are, how to exercise them. Also, in-depth monitoring. So there's a third-party independent body that not only runs a 24-hour live complaint line and complaint resolution mechanism, but also does incredibly in-depth audits on the farms, both announced and unannounced throughout the season to ensure that these things are really being implemented. And finally, again, the most critical mechanism is that of enforcement. So in the event that a slavery case or a sexual assault case happens and the farm fails to remediate the situation sufficiently, then they will lose the business of, as you said, over a dozen major retailers, which is a huge incentive. And so we've seen, because of that combination of transparency and enforcement, that what was once, as you say, home to some incredibly horrific slavery cases and other human rights abuses has now been called the best working environment in American agriculture.
Wow.
Because of the unique effectiveness of this program. And it started in Florida, but it's already up and down the East Coast and is clearly replicable. We see the edges of that potential, not only in agriculture, but in the Bangladeshi textile industry, which recently reached the Bangladesh Accords in order to protect the health and safety of workers in those factories. And that was actually based on the WSR model. And so we see that this actually holds potential to really change the fabric of the international economy.
Marley Moynihan works with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. It's a Florida-based worker-led advocacy group for farm workers. And farm workers are currently on day three of a fast outside of the Manhattan hedge fund offices of Wendy's billionaire board chairman, Nelson Peltz. They are calling on Wendy's to sign on to this very comprehensive fair food program. A dozen large restaurant chains have signed on to the program, but after tomato suppliers implemented it, Wendy's canceled its Florida contract. Ann Lopez, you have been advocating for farm workers and their families for decades. What are your thoughts about the effectiveness of the Fair Food Program?
I think it's fabulous, and we are certainly not there yet. I view slavery as in a much broader context. I don't think we have the horrendous specific cases that you've had in Florida, but what we have is a series of institutions, policies, laws, etc., that keep farm workers trapped and from which escape is nearly impossible. And so what we've done in our organization is start to bring the public's attention to these kind of abuses and push for change, because they're just inappropriate, and we should not be having these kind of human rights abuses in this country, I don't think.
One of the most important parts of this program, I mean, the enforcement is so important, but also the mechanisms for women to report and stop sexual harassment without fear of retaliation. According to a report by the Worker-Driven Social Responsibility Network, 80% of women farm workers experience sexual abuse and harassment. It's so common that many women consider it inevitable. And we did a show a couple years ago about the incredible and very disturbing Frontline documentary called Rape in the Fields. Marley, can you talk about how the Fair Food Program specifically deals with sexual harassment and rape?
Yes. In fact, that that same PBS program did an exclusive piece on the Fair Food Program in the course of their reporting, and one of the producers called it unique in the country in its ability to address sexual violence. So through the program, women are, again, first educated. The most important thing is the first step is to let people know these are what your rights are. This is what sexual harassment looks like, and you now have a right to speak up about it. And when you do so, you won't be the person who's fired this time. And I think that's a really important message to first communicate to women. But again, it's really you have to be able to back that up with a real guarantee. that they will not face the consequence of losing their job or worse, which often for women who are breadwinners means the difference between putting food on the table and not. And so the right to report abuse without retaliation is critically important. Again, that right is actually a part of the code of conduct for the Fair Food Program, and is backed up by those market agreements with these major companies. So to give an example, if a woman does face sexual assault or sexual harassment in the fields, she reports that right away. Under the code, any kind of sexual harassment that involves physical touch, so any kind of sexual assault, is a zero-tolerance policy. What that means is that the person who does that will be fired. There is no second chances. It's a very strict policy. And if a farm fails to do that and said, well, you know, I've had a long time relationship with the supervisor, or he, you know, brings in a great crew, or whatever the reason might be, and the real power dynamics that we all know exist in all workplaces, if those come into play and a farm fails to take the appropriate corrective action for an abuse like that, they will lose business. Mm-hmm. Because it's simply a part of doing business in the 21st century is respecting people's human rights. And so women have reported a drastic drop in sexual harassment and certainly in sexual assault. We haven't had a sexual assault claim in years.
Wow.
In an industry in which women once described that kind of, you know, being groped from behind, women who were told that they had to have sexual relations with a supervisor in order to maintain their job, that was the daily bread of women for so long. And today, you know, one woman actually said, I feel like this program has restored our dignity. I think it's a really...
I mean, it's amazing to hear you talk about the changes. How long did that take?
A remarkably short amount of time, I think. So the program actually began in 2011. So we're in our seventh season. And you have to look at it in the broader spectrum of the history of agriculture and the history of this industry. This has been a problem for hundreds of years. Women farm workers, regardless of what century they lived in, have faced this abuse. And so this is the first time in that process in which that cycle has been truly broken, and there is a new kind of cultural shift within the workplace in agriculture that women are now benefiting from. But not only women, I think it's important to point out that men as well have said that they feel liberated in the sense that they don't work in this very hostile, aggressive environment anymore. That is incredibly disrespectful because, as we know, sexual assault and sexual harassment does not exist in a vacuum. It is connected to an essential power imbalance that gives rise to all kinds of different abuses, whether it's verbal abuse, physical abuse, again, in extreme cases, modern-day slavery. Mm-hmm. And what the Fair Food Program does by giving women a voice, by protecting their ability to speak up, and by backing that up with real consequences, that power imbalance at the root of all of those problems is shifted so that it resolves many things at once, all of these interconnected issues. And so that's, I think, why we've been able to see that kind of fundamental change. But I think the other reason why it happened in the short 6 years after many hundreds of years of abuse was because there are real consequences behind failing to respect those rules. And I think we've seen too many years of impunity, too many years of that kind of behavior going largely unpunished. Mm-hmm. And I think once women and perpetrators started to see, hey, that guy just lost his job. And not only did he lose his job, he was banned from the entire industry for doing that, or was caught up in a criminal investigation, because obviously this is a complement to the law, not a replacement for it. And so I think seeing that those consequences were real and that the protections for women speaking up were real allowed that cultural transformation to occur. And so I'm proud to say, you know, we've been able to address over 2,000 complaints over the course of this program, which is really quite remarkable and a testament to the fact that farm workers really do trust the ability of the program to adjudicate these situations and to arrive at a just solution, and they feel that they can speak up without being fired.
Ann Lopez, the Frontline documentary, Rape in the Fields, launched in 2013, and Frontline said in every farming community in California they visited, women told them that sexual harassment and assault were commonplace in the industry. What has changed for women farm workers in California since this documentary aired?
Nothing. That I know of. Absolutely nothing. Farm workers here are in a different position in the sense that they all live in fear of being deported. We have about 75% of farm workers are undocumented. Most of them came as a result of NAFTA in the late 90s and early 2000s, and they stay hidden. They're afraid to make waves. They are afraid, and the growers are very astute at threats of being blackballed or fired from whatever their organization is. So they don't. Farm workers here, unfortunately, are afraid to rise up. And you know, this is the largest agricultural state. I mean, it's a $47 billion industry in the state, and so the growers have intense control. And yes, a lot of the women, in order to get employment, have to have sex with the boss. I mean, it's just unfortunately commonplace, and many of them don't like to talk about it because they blame themselves. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is one of the biggest tragedies.
And why do you think there's such a difference between farm workers in California and the farm workers in Florida?
You know, I don't know. I'm sitting here pondering that myself. I wish you'd bring whatever your techniques are from Florida to California. But even, you know, we don't even have much UFW activity around here. I have never met a farm worker that's gotten benefit from the UFW even. And so most farm workers feel isolated. They live in grinding poverty. I mean, 16 people living in less than 1,000 square feet with one bathroom and children because the rents are so high. And, you know, I always tell people farm workers need four things primarily. One, that their work is appreciated. Two, they need comprehensive immigration reform. Mm-hmm. No one who's out working 10 hours a day, 6 days a week in the field should be worried about deportation. Mm-hmm. I mean, who's doing who the favor here, you know? And then beyond that, they need a living wage so that they can support their families. And lastly, they need a contract with the grower. So wage theft is rampant. These farm workers work for a long period of time, and the grower leaves without paying them. And it's just, it's disgraceful. Mm. So the conditions here, I think, sound much worse, actually. And like I said, there's even mechanisms to keep farm workers from becoming educated, which we're really fighting against here. We have to take one law or rule at a time, and go after it, but it's almost impossible to escape the poverty the way the system's set up in California, and that's tragic.
And I mean, you're talking about California. Where exactly do you focus your work?
Central California, Watsonville, Salinas, Castroville. Mm. Some in Greenfield, and we're expanding, luckily. But and then we have programs like the 50-mile regulation in the 24 migrant camps in the state, and we're going after the law that regulates farm workers in the migrant camps and forces them to leave and move 50 miles away at the end of the season, which of course disrupts their children's education, and almost nobody graduates from high school. So it's a tremendous loss of human potential and a waste, really, of human potential. And almost all the farm workers I've ever talked to want in life is that their children become educated and out of farm work. And there are mechanisms set up and in place that make that nearly impossible. And we're going after those first.
Wow. Ann Lopez is a researcher and farm worker advocate, executive director of the Center for Farm Worker Families in California. She's talking about how farm workers in Central California are treated. We're also joined by Marlene Moynihan. She works with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, a Florida-based worker-led advocacy group for farm workers. Florida farm workers are fasting. They're on day three. Outside of the Manhattan hedge fund offices of Wendy's billionaire board chair, Nelson Peltz. We'll talk about more about Nelson Peltz after the break. But before we do that, Marley, what goes through your mind when you hear Ann talk about how horribly farm workers in Central California are treated? And why do you think there's such a difference between farm workers in Florida and farm workers here?
Well, first, I just feel a deep sense of empathy. I think that these are the kinds of abuses that Florida farm workers also faced for many years, and not only in Florida, but we continue to see those same types of abuses, whether it's wage theft or sexual assault or forced labor in many states up and down the East Coast that still don't have this program. And so I think that the key ingredients here are certainly workers getting together and coming together to establish what it is that they want to accomplish, what are the major issues for them, and then finding a way to really make those rights enforceable. I also want to say to Ann and to everyone out there, I think that the story of Immokalee shows that you can come from a horrific situation, a horrific landscape of incredible vulnerability and powerlessness, and you can still create, a community can still create change. And I think this program, as we've seen it become replicated and grow, again, it expanded from Florida tomatoes to now 7 or 8 states and 3 crops. And so the program itself and the model has the potential to expand and to replicate. We very much hope it will someday be the norm within U.S. agriculture. And I think that it has the ability to do that with the right amount of support, and not only from different farm worker organizations, but also from consumers. Because it is a market-based solution, this has to be something that also comes from the people who buy food at the end of the day. They have to say that the health and well-being of the women and men who harvest our food is just as important as the quality and safety of the product that arrives on their plate. I think that just has to be reflected in the purchasing choices, not only of consumers, but of corporations as well, which is, again, where the question of Wendy's and other companies that are not yet participating or supporting this come into the picture. There's so many people out there, many executives out there, who do not yet recognize their responsibility, which comes with their power as these large retailers, to ensure human rights protections in their supply chain. And we very much hope that this program will grow, both in its partners, in different corporations, like with Wendy's, and also in its geographical reach.
We'll get a comment from Ann right after the break. Today we are talking about farm workers in Florida. I'm sorry, in New York. Florida farm workers are on day three of a fast outside of a hedge fund office, Wendy's billionaire board chair Nelson Peltz. He and his fund own almost 55 million shares of Wendy's. He has a net worth of $1.5 billion. The farm workers are calling on Wendy's to sign on to the Fair Food Program, which was created by Florida tomato pickers. We're talking about that with Marlene Moynihan. She works with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, a Florida-based worker-led advocacy group for farm workers. And Ann Lopez is a researcher and farm worker advocate. She's the executive director of the Center for Farm Worker Families in California. She works with farm workers in Central California. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation about guns and gun violence. Tomorrow, students from across the country are expected to walk out of school to remember the kids and the teachers who were killed in Parkland, Florida on February 14th. Since then, there have been over 800 school-based incidents and threats, according to the Educators School Safety Network. 15 students have been arrested, 29 cases cases involved a gun. We will talk about what it will take to get to the heart of the problem and help kids in distress. Why are so many students lashing out with threats of violence? That's tomorrow. And then we'll also be speaking on Thursday with Robert Reich about his new book, The Common Good. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. Today we are talking about farm workers fighting for their rights. Florida farm workers are fasting for the third day outside of the hedge fund offices of Wendy's billionaire board chair Nelson Peltz. That's in Manhattan. They are calling on Wendy's to sign on to the Fair Food Program. Farm workers say the program has created a mechanism for women to report and stop sexual harassment without fear of retaliation. It also has very strong enforcement mechanisms. Wendy's decided to cancel its Florida contract after tomato suppliers implemented the program. We're talking about this with Marley Moynihan. She works with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, a Florida-based worker-led advocacy group for farm workers. And Ann Lopez is executive director of the Center for Farm Worker Families in California. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Do you or your family work in agriculture? What can you tell us about the treatment of farm workers? What are your thoughts about boycotts? There's a Driscoll's boycott happening, and hopefully we'll get someone to call in about that. The farm workers from Florida are also calling for a Wendy's boycott until the food giant joins the Fair Food Program. And I wanted you to respond to Marley. What are your thoughts about, you know, what she said about solidarity with California farm workers and what it might take to get some kind of fair food program in this state?
I would love that. I would love to see farm workers rise up. I really would. From what I've observed, it's been more of a thing of just tolerating the abuse and putting up with the conditions, and any help comes from the outside. Lorena Gonzalez, for instance, in the state legislature, introduced AB 1066, I believe, and that will give farm workers overtime pay beginning in 2019, and also will shorten their workday eventually down to 8 hours. But a lot of it hinges on agricultural exceptionalism, which is really the main codified law governing the lives of farm workers. And basically, this agricultural exceptionalism law says that farm workers don't have rights, and corporations and companies can pretty much do whatever they want with them. And until we do something with that core issue, I don't know that it's going to change, at least across the country. I think that we need a new set of laws governing farm workers so that they are also subjected to the same ones that people in manufacturing are, like the Fair Labor Standards Act or the National Labor Relations Act. And right now they don't, because of agricultural exceptionalism. So that's my biggest concern. But I see farm workers just living in fear, trying to survive. And many of them say, as bad as conditions are here, they're better than what they were dealing with in Mexico. And I went to Oaxaca and visited a family last May, and I can say that that's probably true, even with 16 people living in 1,000 square feet. I mean, there's absolutely nothing but concrete to sleep on for some of these families. I mean, it's really, the poverty is just indescribable and unnecessary. I really think we need a worldwide war on poverty. Mm. I would love to see the diversion of part of the military budget away from killing and destroying and into the constructive act of ending poverty on this planet. Mm.
And what about the Democratic Party here in California and the Democrats in D.C., Kamala Harris and Dianne Feinstein? I mean, they love to embrace this idea that California is the state that is resisting Donald Trump. But what about farm workers? What have they done for farm workers?
You know, I don't hear anything. I just think farm workers are invisible. They keep a low profile. When I was when I first started my research in 97, there was absolutely nothing. I mean, I had to go to great lengths to develop trust in the community so I could go in and find out what was going on. I mean, they're just invisible beings in the grand scheme of things. And some Latinos seem to be concerned, Latino legislators like Lorena Gonzalez, but in general, they're not spoken about, and that's why I do. My policy is that I will speak to whomever will listen. And people are visibly shaken when I give my talks and show the slides and present the data. And there is more and more information coming out in newspapers. For instance, on the 3rd, there was a whole article about how the deportations now and ICE are threatening California agriculture because workers are going back to Mexico. They don't want their families split up. So generally speaking, I think, in fact, I live in a county, Santa Cruz County. We have North County that's mostly Anglo and South County that's mostly Mexican. And there's hardly any cross-pollination between those two areas, even in the same county. It's quite remarkable, and we're doing a lot of things to bridge that gap now. But I just see that there isn't much going on. And I think that growers have tremendous power in this state and probably have an effect in terms of their effect on legislators and what they vote for and that kind of thing. But there isn't a huge movement. We don't have marches and boycotts and all the things, wonderful things we had during Cesar Chavez time. It's just very quiet, and that concerns me. That's why I'm a hellraiser.
Ann Lopez is Executive Director of the Center for Farmworker Families in California. To that point, Ann, we have a caller, Phil in San Francisco, who'd like to talk about the UFW. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose. She touched on just what one of the things I was thinking about being a native Californian growing up in the Bay Area was the fact of when there was the iceberg lettuce boycott. As I became a young adult, I did work as a labor negotiator for the computer operations where my employment was. And I come to realize that for some reason, currently, we have drifted so far from advocating for the workers. The unions, they have their own agenda, and and this I learned from firsthand experience, and thusly the workers are somewhat underrepresentative, understrengthened, impoverished, and yet the relationship between management and corporations and the unions on one level being legally separated, it smells of cahoots. And so my comment is, the current generations, they seem to think that weekends are nice, but they fail to realize that if it weren't for unions, there wouldn't be a weekend. We'd still be on the agrarian's schedule of 6.5 days.
And that's
so very good, and thank you very much, Rose.
Thank you.
You do a wonderful job.
Thank you, Phil. Ann?
Yeah, well, I agree. That's exactly it. In fact, last week I talked to a council person on the Watsonville City Council that told me that I was the only one advocating for farm workers other than people that work with me. Now, to me, to have such blatant abuse, to me, what I see in Watsonville is a form of slavery. In fact, if I ever get enough time, I'm going to write another book called Slavery in Our Own Backyard. Mm. because people are trapped. I mean, there's almost no way out, and that people can live with that when slavery was supposed to end in the 1800s is amazing to me. I mean, especially in a progressive county and state like California, for people to tolerate this kind of thing. And luckily, as I speak, and I do farm worker reality tours where I bring groups together with farm workers so they can hear the stories I've been hearing for years, there is more and more interest in doing something about this. But, I mean, to me, it's intolerable. If we had, you know, a child abuse factory in Watsonville, I'm sure that there would be an outcry. And why this is normalized, why the abuse that I see every day is normalized, is really beyond me. And that's what it is.
Well, thank you for calling in, Phil. Marley, do you also want to jump in there?
Yes, I think that just one reflection is that for many years, in the CIW's earliest years, it's actually a 25-year-old organization, did spend many years doing more traditional labor actions like work stoppages, trying to strike up a dialogue with growers in order to ask that same question: why is this normal? Mm-hmm. Why aren't farm workers treated like human beings? And
yeah,
though they made some modest progress, I think that there was a point at which the combination of those many years of work that did not yield a real transformation of the industry, combined with the fact that even the laws that are on the books largely go unenforced. And when they are enforced, at least in Florida, the consequences for the growers, for example, for allowing this abuse to persist, are basically a slap on the wrist.
That's right. So
farm workers really did the analysis and said, well, who would the growers listen to? Who does have the power to make this change? And it was at that point that they actually saw an article that described how Taco Bell had this an agreement with one grower that they would purchase from them year-round, but for a very, very low price. And it was this understanding and this light bulb of seeing that really within the marketplace there was incredible power, and that those large corporations at the top of the supply chain were really where both the profit and the power was really being concentrated. And with that power, again, comes responsibility. Just like a corporation can say, I need this size tomato, I need it to look like this, I need it to have it these food safety regulations, they have the same ability to say, you also have to implement human rights protections in order for me to buy your product, and to make that to make their purchases predicated on that kind of protection. And so it was really that analysis and coming out of that sense of despair, of the sense that things won't change and that this cycle of fear and abuse can't be broken. And I would also comment that it does go back for many, many years, even before the vast majority of agriculture was done by immigrants of mixed status. These types of abuses persisted when African Americans, and of course prior to African slaves, that they all face this kind of abuse. It's really rooted in the way that the economy is structured. This mm-hmm. country was founded on an agricultural system of free labor, and
right.
we've never really moved on from that. And so that's why these kinds of conditions continue to persist until we change the structure of the economy and change the incentive. Because I think that, you know, if you look at any really endemic, widespread abuse, whether it's sexual violence or human trafficking, it's not ultimately about, you know, harvesting that particular product or having sex with that person. It's about power and it's about money. And so if you can shift the imbalance of power and change the direction of the incentive of money, where it suddenly is your job on the line and that there's no way for you to make money either as a grower or as a supervisor if you participate in that kind of reprehensible behavior, then you were going to see some real change.
Well,
and so I do think that there is some hope on the horizon.
Speaking of money, the Florida farm workers are right now in front of the Manhattan hedge fund offices of Wendy's billionaire board chair Nelson Peltz. His Train Fund Management Group owns 54 million shares of Wendy's. This is according to The Street. Wendy's is trading at $17 a share right now. According to Forbes, Nelson Peltz has a net worth of $1.5 billion. Marley, why are the farm workers protesting and fasting in front of Nelson Peltz's office?
So after all of this progress that we've already talked about, the elimination of sexual violence in the fields and of forced labor and, you know, and hugely addressing other endemic issues such as ones that Anna's mentioned, like wage theft and health and safety violations, we've made all of this progress, and yet there still are many companies who are not yet on board with this program. And that is a real impediment to its expansion, because we recognize at the same time we celebrate these changes that have happened and recognize the model, but also know that there are many, many more, millions of more farm workers, whether in California or anywhere in the United States, that grows all of the products that end up on our plates, who are still facing those conditions, as Anne has so clearly discussed. And so the expansion of models like this are critically important, and that's only going to happen with greater support from those retailers, because as I've mentioned, it's really that those market consequences, that commitment of buyers to cut their purchases from growers who violate farm workers' rights, that drives that kind of change. And so Wendy's has been particularly egregious in its response to the program. So not only did they say, I'm not going to participate in this, but in fact, as you mentioned, pulled their purchases from Florida altogether and moved to Mexico. And Anne was just talking about how even in some of the worst conditions here, don't compare to the conditions in Mexico. And so the ironic thing that Wendy's has decided to do is simultaneously make one of the most unethical decisions that I could personally imagine in rejecting a proven solution to some of these abuses and choosing to partner with an industry that is well known to be incredibly corrupt, to be riddled with violence. I mean, Mexico in general has very little rule of law. There's an incredible amount of impunity and just a widespread level of violence. In particular, femicide and violence against women is incredibly common. And yet at the same time, Wendy's says that they have their own code of conduct, that is ensuring the human rights of farm workers in their supply chain, which is a pretty incredible statement to make when you choose to purchase from an industry that is, by definition, not transparent. And in the few glimpses that we do get of conditions in Mexico, we know that they are horrifying. There have been many reports throughout the years. There was an incredible expose out of the LA Times, actually, called Product of Mexico from 2014. In which reporters went down and documented horrific cases of modern-day slavery and other human rights abuses throughout the Mexican agricultural industry. And so I think Wendy's has to make a decision. If they really want to show to consumers and show, more importantly, to farm workers who are harvesting their products that they are committed to human rights, then they need to take steps to do so. And I think, you know, as one of my coworkers said, to summarize why we're here in New York, why over 80 people are fasting on the doorstep of one of Wendy's most powerful executives. You know, my colleague Lupe Gonzalo said, today we come to Mr. Peltz's doorstep with a proven solution in hand. Inaction in the face of a problem like sexual assault is unacceptable, but inaction in the face of a solution is unconscionable. And I think that's what's really brought us here today.
We reached out to Wendy's, and they sent us a statement saying that the Coalition of Immokalee Workers is spreading false and misleading information about Wendy's. It goes on to say, we will not join their program and pay fees directly to them. What do they mean by that?
Well, I wish I could say that Wendy's was perhaps confused about the structure of the program, but unfortunately for them, the information and the truth about how the program works is extremely available to the public. I think that they're trying to refer to is the fact that there is an economic relief piece of the Fair Food Program. As Anne mentioned, grinding poverty is something that farm workers share across this country. And we recognized in the creation of the Fair Food Program that you can't have that kind of poverty and real change go hand in hand. There has to be a shift in the economic state of these families in order for farm workers to really participate. Because if you feel like your job is on the line and you live paycheck to paycheck and have no buffer, it is highly unlikely that you are going to truly speak up in your workplace and risk losing your job. And so as a result, in addition to the code of conduct, the Fair Food Program also has a penny per pound bonus. So that is paid by large retailers like all of Wendy's competitors. It is paid in the form of a premium to the same grower, just with their regular payment. The growers then pass it on to workers in the form of a bonus. It goes into their paychecks. And so what Wendy's is insinuating somehow is that economic relief destined for farm workers' wallets is somehow getting to the CIW. And at no point in the process does the CIW have anything to do with that money. That is incredibly well documented. We've had the privilege of having many labor experts and authors and writers and researchers come down and study the Fair Food Program. There's a recent book out, actually, just out of the RAND Priority Public Policy School by the dean there, Susan Marquis, called I Am Not a Tractor, and it very clearly details she had access to see many of these documents. It's very clear that the penny per pound goes straight to farm workers. And I think the saddest thing about Wendy's impugning that piece of the program is that it's been so successful. This it might sound not like very much to people listening, but there has been over $26 million distributed in additional wages to farm workers since the inception of the program, and we've really seen that make a difference and lift up our community just because of that relatively small commitment from enough buyers can make a huge difference. And so to suggest that that's somehow a corrupt instrument of the CIW, I think, is shameful.
Marley, we don't have much time left, but according to your website, a simple workday for a Florida tomato picker involves backbreaking work, eating lunch as fast as they can, often with their hands soaked in pesticides. They return to work under the smoldering Florida sun. It's very hot there. So 5 to 6 days a week, 10 to 12 hour days. What is the average wage for an Immokalee worker?
Well, prior to the Fair Food Program, farm workers in Florida, I think that the average as calculated, not for Florida specifically, but nationally, workers make between around $12,500 a year on average. It's an incredibly low wage for incredibly hard work, as you just described. And so workers are actually paid by the bucket. And I think that's one of the reasons why the penny per pound process works so well, because it conforms to the way that workers are already paid and is able to increase their wages with this additional bonus. And so, again, we've seen that the impact of that mean anything from an extra $20 to an extra $100 in a worker's paycheck every week, which makes a huge difference, especially for families. And so poverty is certainly still a major issue. But at the same time, we are taking steps in the right direction with using this model.
So $12,500, maybe up to $14,000 a year. Wendy's CEO Todd Penegor makes $5 million a year. Robert Wright, the COO, makes $2 million a year. And last year, Robert Wright told investors that Wendy's plans to install self-serve ordering kiosks in 1,000 restaurants to, quote, reduce labor costs. And a number of labor activists said it's because cashiers and others who work in the restaurant are demanding $15 an hour, whereas now they make an average of $8 an hour on average. Ann Lopez, what about average wages for farm workers in California?
Well, the lowest I've heard is $5 an hour. The highest is about $11 an hour. Many of them get paid by the piecemeal, hours and cases, they call it, and so they get paid around $3.25 an hour, and then $1.70 for a case of 12 baskets of strawberries or 8 large baskets. Most of them make between $13,000 and $17,000 a year, which is no one can live on that in the Central Coast. I have a farm worker I work very closely with, a woman with four children. She works 6 days a week, 10 hours a day, also in the hot sun and exposed to pesticides. And her salary does not pay the rent. So she has to rent out a bedroom in her house in order to have money to buy food for the family. So it's grim. I mean, it's living on the edge of survival. And California was scheduled to become a slave state prior to the Emancipation Proclamation. And I think that edict or that way of thinking has persisted in the agricultural industry, which has been incredibly successful economically, mm-hmm. but in terms of human beings and human rights, it's been a dismal failure.
And
average life expectancy of a farm worker here is only 49 years.
Wow. I'm sorry to cut you off. We're almost out of time, Anne, but I don't want to end without asking you, what can people in California do to support farm workers here? Just quickly.
Come on a farm worker reality tour. We have them scheduled on our website, farmworkerfamily.org. Make donations to our organization. Every penny goes to the farm workers. We are all a group of volunteers. We have people providing in-kind services, tutoring services. There's any number of ways people can participate in improving the lives of farm workers. So just contact our organization on our website, and we'd love to have you aboard.
And quickly, Marley, over 80 farm workers are on day 3 of their fast. They will be fasting until Thursday, and then they plan to protest.
Absolutely. And there's actually many ways for people across the country, even if you cannot be in New York in 2 days, there are many ways in which people here can help support this action and support the CIW's movement more broadly. There's actually a petition circulating to express that support and to call on Wendy's to join the Fair Food Program and to state your support for the Freedom Fast. All of that can be found on our website and on our Facebook page. And even more so, to get involved. I think that the Fair Food Program and the campaign for fair food is built on relationships between farm workers and consumers. And by being both educated and active in following the lead of farm workers and supporting their campaigns like the Campaign for Fair Food and doing things like boycotting Wendy's, every individual consumer can make a difference and make a statement to all the places that they work that ethical purchasing is now a requirement for our society.
Marley Moynihan works for the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, and Lopez is Executive Director of the Center for Farm Worker Families in California. Thank you both so much for joining us, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.